morning, everyone. Hopefully you slept well. Let's start with a short meditation just to prepare ourselves well for our discussions today. So find a nice comfortable posture. And as an act of loving kindness for yourself, let go of any external distractions and bring your awareness into your own body, becoming aware of sensations throughout the body. And if you notice any area of tightness or tension in any part of your body, then use your out-breath to relax and release that tightness or tension. And then bring your awareness to the area of your face and soften and relax all the muscles in the area of the face, mouth and jaw soft and relaxed, and all the muscles around the eyes soft and relaxed. In this way, allowing your entire body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. Then you can take 3 slow, deep breaths, maintaining awareness of sensations throughout the body as you breathe. And then allow your breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. Not trying to control or regulate the breath in any way. Simply allow the breathing to flow naturally, effortlessly. And with each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen, simply release them. Give yourself permission to let go of any hopes or fears, worries or concerns about the past or the future for the duration of this short meditation. You can attend to those things later if you want. But now, simply allow yourself the luxury and freedom of letting go of all of these things. And simply allow the mind to come to rest in the present moment. Through focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body, maintaining an ongoing flow of mindfulness of the sensations of the breath throughout the body. We all want to be happy, and we all want to be free of problems and suffering. And it often seems to us as if the source of our happiness and the source of our suffering is out there in the world. As a result, one of the main methods we use to try to find happiness and to try to overcome suffering is that we try to manipulate the things around us. We try to attract people, places, and things that seem to be the source of our happiness. And we try to push away or avoid people, places, and things that seem to be the source of our suffering. But no matter how hard we try to control the things around us, we still manage to find suffering. And we're still chasing after that elusive happiness. All we are really doing with this method of trying to manipulate things around us is that we are trapping ourselves in the hope-fear cycle. Hoping for pleasant experiences and fearing or worrying about unpleasant experiences. And if we don't get the things we want, we often become very frustrated. And even if we do get the things we want, they never really completely satisfy us, and we simply end up craving for more. And we often have a lot of dissatisfaction and disappointment when things don't live up to our expectations. However, if we look more closely, we'll come to realize that the real source of our suffering and the real source of our happiness is not out there in the world. It lies within our own mind. The real source of our suffering is our mental afflictions, such as attachment, aversion, anger, jealousy, fear, anxiety, depression. These mental afflictions are the real source of our suffering. and these mental afflictions all come from a distorted view of reality. They all come from grasping onto a belief that there is an independent me here and an independent objective world out there. They all come from self-grasping, grasping onto an independent me, a self. And this self-grasping mind often leads to self-cherishing. Self-cherishing is the belief that my happiness is more important than the happiness of anyone else. So we need to overcome self-grasping and self-cherishing. How can we do this? Through cultivating wisdom and compassion. Through cultivating the wisdom, realizing emptiness, we can overcome self-grasping. And through cultivating bodhicitta, we can overcome self-cherishing and instead develop the mind of cherishing others. And the Lojong system of practice can enable us to cultivate these two things. Emptiness and bodhicitta. And another strength of the Lojong system of practice is that it enables us to take adverse conditions into the spiritual path. Often we are faced with obstacles and difficulties in our life and our practice. But the Lojong system of practice gives very practical advice on how to see these difficult situations not as problems or obstacles, but rather as opportunities. So we can use these difficult situations to progress in our practice. So we can set a motivation for this course of wishing to learn and understand how to engage in this Lojong practice. So that we can internalize this wisdom and compassion and integrate it into our daily life. So that we can overcome self-grasping and self-cherishing and all the suffering that they produce. So that we can find genuine happiness. But not just for ourselves, so that we can also effectively help those around us also to overcome their self-grasping and self-cherishing and the suffering that that produces. So we can try to set this motivation for our time together here during these days. And keeping this motivation in mind, we can now slowly end this meditation and begin our discussions together today. So let's begin by reviewing a little bit what we covered yesterday. So we are using this text here called the 7-point mind training. Mind training here is a translation of a Tibetan word, lojong. And we can understand that in general, of course, all of Buddhist teachings are lojong, or mind training. That we are trying to transform our mind. We are trying to reduce and eliminate suffering and its causes. We're trying to cultivate and increase happiness and its causes. And the two main areas of practice for that, of course, is the two wings of wisdom and compassion. And these two aspects of practice, of course, we can approach at a number of levels. And so we saw yesterday how the Buddha, after he achieved enlightenment, then taught what was called the three turnings of the wheel of Dharma. And in the first turning of the wheel of Dharma, he taught the Four Noble Truths, which are the foundation of all Buddhist traditions. And in the Four Noble Truths level of teachings, he taught that the reason we are stuck in this unsatisfactory state is because of our mental afflictions and ignorance, and that we can overcome this ignorance and mental afflictions and achieve this healthy state beyond suffering and its causes, this healthy state of nirvana. And that to achieve this goal of nirvana, we need to come to realize no self. So self here is an overinflated sense of me. We really do grasp onto this belief that there is this solid autonomous me here. And that we need to come to realize there's no such me, there's no self. And if we can realize this, we can overcome all of our mental afflictions and achieve liberation from suffering. So then at this level of the practice, this was the teachings that initially spread from India through the Pali language, and this spread to places such as Sri Lanka, Burma, Thailand, Laos, Cambodia. So these traditions, which collectively now are called Theravada traditions, emphasize the Four Noble Truths and talk about the goal of Nirvana. So what we could understand is that the wisdom aspect of the practice at this level, at the Four Noble Truths level, were these three marks of existence that we briefly mentioned yesterday. That we first come to realize impermanence, the fact that everything's changing moment by moment. And by realizing that everything's changing moment by moment, that will help us to realize there's nothing out there that's going to provide us with any lasting happiness, because everything's changing. Thereby, by realizing impermanence, that will help us to realize dukkha. Dukkha, of course, is the word that the Buddha used to describe our current condition. Of course, this is the first noble truth of the Four Noble Truths. So we can come to more easily recognize or realize this unsatisfactory state we find ourselves in through having realized impermanence. And then by realizing this dukkha, that will enable us to stop looking out there for any lasting happiness, because there is none to be found out there. Then rather, we will turn our attention inwards to understand that the source of happiness lies within ourselves. So from this realization of dukkha, we can develop the aspiration to be liberated from this unsatisfactory state, the aspiration for nirvana. Then to strive for the goal of nirvana, we need to, of course, realize no self. There is no solid, substantial me here. So this is the wisdom aspect of the practice within the Theravada, or the Four Noble Truths level of teachings. In the compassion wing of the practice, normally we talk about the four immeasurables. Sometimes in the Theravada traditions, these are called the four Brahma Viharas. These are four qualities we are trying to develop towards immeasurable sentient beings, meaning towards all sentient beings, all living beings. Of course, these are loving kindness, compassion, third one is, of course, loving kindness is the wish for ourselves and others to have happiness in its causes, whereas compassion is the wish for ourselves and others to be free of suffering and its causes. Loving kindness, of course, in Sanskrit is maitri, or in Pali, metta. Compassion is karuna. The third is empathetic joy. Thank you. in Sanskrit Pali, mudita. And this is a rejoicing in our own and others' virtues and good fortune. The fourth is equanimity, or upeksha in Sanskrit. And this equanimity here is a even attitude towards everyone. And this is having a sense of closeness to everyone, meaning that we are all stuck in the same situation. We're all trying to be happy. We're all trying to be free of suffering. We're all equal in this regard. So this is the line of thinking we can use to develop equanimity. Because now we tend to have a very biased attitude. And how we relate to others is often coming from this self-cherishing mind, meaning that we tend to categorize people into three groups depending on how they affect me and my happiness. Those people who seem to support me and my happiness, we label friend. Those people around us who don't seem to affect me and my happiness in any way, we label stranger. And those people around us who seem to interfere with me and my happiness, the so-called enemy. Then based on this self-cherishing mind, then of course we have a lot of attachment to our friends because they seem to be the source of our happiness. And then we have a lot of apathy and indifference to strangers because they don't seem to affect me and my happiness in any way. So I don't care what happens to them. And then, of course, the so-called enemy who seem to be interfering with me and my happiness, we have a lot of aversion, hostility, anger, and hatred. So we end up with attachment to friends, apathy, indifference to strangers, and then hostility, anger, and hatred to the so-called enemy. We need to overcome this biased attitude by developing equanimity, by understanding that we're all stuck in the same situation. My happiness is no more important than the happiness of anyone else. We're all equal in wanting to be happy, wanting to be free of suffering. And therefore, we can develop this even attitude towards everyone and this sense of closeness that we're all stuck in the same situation. So these are the four immeasurables that we are trying to develop in the compassion wing of practice within this level of practice. So this is the wisdom and compassion here. This 7-point mind training text, of course, was introduced into Tibet through great Indian master Atisha. And he was coming from the Mahayana tradition. Where the Mahayana, of course, is building on this basis of the Four Noble Truths. Meaning, in the Mahayana, we are not simply striving for our own liberation from suffering, but we are striving for the goal of enlightenment so that we can help liberate everyone else from suffering as well. So, in the compassion wing of practice, we are building on the basis of the four immeasurables and we are going to the next level of bodhicitta. Because here in the four immeasurables, we are developing loving kindness and compassion to all sentient beings. We're trying to help all sentient beings as much as we can. But within bodhicitta, we take that to the next level. And that is, we make it our personal responsibility to liberate all sentient beings from samsara. So this is a big jump or big step on top of the four immeasurables. So remember, citta is mind and bodhi is enlightenment. So this is the mind of enlightenment. sometimes the word body also really means awakening. So what we find actually in this 7-point mind training commentary we're looking at, the word bodhicitta has been translated as the mind of awakening, because the word body means to be awakened, to be fully awakened. So that's how it's been translated here in this commentary we're going to follow, the mind of awakening, or the sometimes called the mind of enlightenment. Or often you'll see the original Sanskrit word used, bodhicitta. And remember, there were two main methods used to develop bodhicitta in ancient India that were taught. The seven cause and effect method and the exchanging self with others method. Here, and the seven cause and effect was the main method that was taught. And so in many of the traditions in the Mahayana, this is the main method that will be taught, how to develop bodhicitta. In the Lojong system of practice, which we are following, we will be using this second method, which historically was actually considered too difficult for the normal person to implement. But I think particularly in our modern society, this approach can be very, very effective. So I think the Lojong approach in our, particularly our modern society, can be a very powerful method to develop bodhicitta. On the wisdom side of the practice here, we are trying to develop the wisdom of emptiness, or shunyata in Sanskrit. So we are building on top of the three marks of existence as the basis here. Because with emptiness, we are understanding that there is a deeper level of ignorance than just this ignorance grasping onto self, this overinflated sense of me. Here, the deepest level of ignorance operating is this belief of an independent me and an independent objective world out there. So emptiness is a realization that there is no independent me, no independent objective world. So this is the wisdom side of the practice at the Mahayana level. So we here in this Lojong system of practice, again, this is part of the Mahayana tradition. So in the two main areas of practice of wisdom and compassion, we are going to be looking at this wisdom of emptiness, and in the compassion wing, we're going to be looking at bodhicitta in terms of this exchanging self with others approach to practice, meaning exchanging the self-cherishing mind with the mind of cherishing others. So this is going to be the core of the compassion wing of the practice in the Lojong system. And so remember, we said that in the text, right at the beginning of the 7-point mind training text, in the commentary on the first page, it said, as far as their subject matter is concerned, all these vehicles present either directly or indirectly the elimination of self-grasping and the cherishing of others, the two themes. Since there is only self-grasping to be eliminated and the well-being of others to be sought, those engaged in the practice of the Buddha's teachings must understand how to relate whatever practice they undertake to these two endeavors. So here, then, we need to overcome this self-grasping mind. That self-grasping mind, of course, is overcome by the wisdom of emptiness, realizing that there is no independent self.
And then the other main fault, of course, we looked at yesterday was the self-cherishing mind. So the self-cherishing mind, of course, is overcome by the bodhicitta. In particular here, the practice of exchanging self with others, meaning exchanging the self-cherishing attitude with the attitude of cherishing others. So these are the two main faults that we need to overcome in our practice, the self-grasping mind through the wisdom practice and the self-cherishing mind through the compassion practice here of bodhicitta in the Mahayana. So this is what we are going to be looking at in the 7-point mind training, is these two core practices. But as I also mentioned in the meditation this morning, one of the other great strengths of the Lojong system of practice is that there is a lot of practical advice about how to take adverse conditions into the spiritual path. Because we are often faced with difficulties and obstacles in our life and our practice, and often we see these as problems, and then it becomes some huge daunting suffering from that. Whereas, and we can know this from our own experience, is that often the times when we most developed as a person was as a result of some big problem in our life. Because if our life is sort of drifting along without any difficulty, we tend to just drift along in life and not really do anything much with our life. It's only when we're faced with a very difficult situation that it forces us to reevaluate our life, and it forces us to develop as a person to overcome this difficulty. But at that time, of course, often we saw the difficulty as a big problem, and we had a lot of aversion to this problem, which really magnifies the amount of suffering we experience. So, of course, we learned from that difficult situation and probably developed as a person, but we inflicted a lot of unnecessary suffering on ourselves in that occasion because of our aversion to it, because of seeing that difficult situation as a problem. Whereas here in the Lojong system of practice, it gives us very practical advice about how to see the difficult situation not as a problem but as an opportunity, which means that instead of inducing a lot of unnecessary suffering through our aversion, we can use these difficult situations as fuel for the spiritual path, and we can benefit immensely from these difficult situations. So I think this is one of the other great strengths of the Lojong system of practice, and I think particularly in our modern society we seem to be faced with a lot of difficulties, physical and mental. Then we can take advantage of this advice here in the Lojong system. So that is a little bit a review of what we covered yesterday. So what I'd like to do now is to move on in the text, and we'll be starting from, I'll use the numbering on the top of the commentary. So on page 89. We're going to start the text. Before that, is there any questions about any of the things we covered yesterday that's still not clear?
I think you mentioned yesterday that the understanding of happiness becoming better than the third training was a little different. Maybe I missed your explanation.
Sure. I haven't had an explanation yet. But so remember, the first turning of the wheel, the Four Noble Truths, is the basis of this level of practice. And then in the second and third turning of the wheel, I said that both of those wheels talked about emptiness and bodhicitta. The bodhicitta that they talk about is more or less the same. The emptiness that is taught in the second and third turning of the wheel is slightly different. See, in the first turning of the wheel, Four Noble Truths, the problem is that we overinflate the sense of me. We believe in this self, this solid, autonomous me. So here, how we see the world is not a problem. So at this level of the teachings, there is an objective world out there made up of little particles. So this is a little bit like classical physics approach. You know, there is an objective physical world out there. That's not a problem. The problem is how we see ourselves as a person. We overinflate the sense of me. We believe in this self. That's the problem. Whereas in the second and third turning of the wheel, the Buddha said, yes, this is a problem, but there's a deeper problem. The deeper problem is that there is no independent objective world out there. That's a more subtle level of ignorance. So emptiness is saying that there is no independent objective world out there. And the difference being in the second and third turning of the wheel is the conclusion that is drawn out of that. In the second turning of the wheel, it's rejected that there is no independent external world out there. The conclusion is that there is a dependent external world out there. Whereas the problem with that is that idea of emptiness for many people is too subtle to appreciate. And it sounds like what we're saying is that nothing exists. So there's a great danger from the second turning wheel to fall to the extreme of nihilism, thinking that emptiness there means, oh, nothing really exists, doesn't matter, I can do whatever I want. So this is not a good result to have this wrong understanding. So the third turning of the wheel is to provide like a step to that, a sort of more simple idea of emptiness. So in the third turning of the wheel, emptiness means, so remember both second and third turning of the wheel are refuting that there is an independent external world out there. The third turning of the wheel says there's no independent external world because there's an independent internal world, that everything is the mind. So this is what's called the mind-only or Chittamatra philosophical system. So that emptiness there is slightly different, saying that there is no external independent world because there's an independent internal world. There's no external reality whatsoever. So that's a little bit the difference, and we may briefly touch on that later in the text. But they both refute what's being accepted here, that there is an independent external world. They both refute that. And again, if you really want to know about this in very much detail, then the course here in June from Geshe Kelsang Wangmo, she'll be talking about all of these things in detail. Okay, let's now go into the text. So we're on page 89 in the middle, and it starts off with these 7 points. So remember these Lojong teachings were introduced into Tibet through the great Indian master Lama Atisha around the 10th, 11th century. And from his teachings, so he had two approaches to his teachings. One was the more public approach, where he taught to the masses. He taught from his text that he wrote, The Lamp for the Path, which is the basis of the Lam Rim. So to the masses of the public, he taught the Lam Rim approach, where he taught the 7 cause and effect method for bodhicitta. But he also taught a little bit more secretively to those people who could really appreciate and follow that approach. He taught this Lojong system, where he taught the exchanging self with others method for bodhicitta. And from these teachings, then this Lojong system of practice really started to develop extensively in in those early centuries of Tibetan Buddhism, from the 11th century onwards. And so we have quite a number of texts using this Lojong approach. As I mentioned briefly yesterday, out of all of those texts, the two main ones that we see being used today to explain Lojong practice is the one we're using, the 7-point mind training, and then the 8 verses of mind training is the other main text from Geshe Langri Tampa. If you're interested in looking at some of the other texts, then this is a very good book here called Essential Mind Training from Thupten Jinpa, who's translator for His Holiness Dalai Lama. And the commentary, the actual commentary we're using in this course is coming from this book. It's his translation of the commentary. So I think there are about 18 texts in here, Lojong texts, various ones. So if you're interested in, there's the 8 verses of mind training, a commentary on that, and then a number of other Lojong texts in here as well. So that would be a good reference material. So remember then, this 7-point mind training is consisting of 57 very short statements, often called slogans. These statements are coming from Lama Atisha, but they were systematized and put into these 7 groups, or these 7 points, through Geshe Chikawa. And so therefore, it's often said that Geshe Chikawa is the author of the 7-point mind training. Whereas technically, all the points within that are coming from Atisha. So we need to sort of keep that in mind. So let's see how then Geshe Chikawa breaks up these 57 points into these 7 57 slogans into these 7 points. So we have the 7 points mentioned here. And of course, we can see that at the beginning of our booklet, there's the 57 points with the 57 slogans with the 7 points mentioned. So let's just briefly go through the 7 points here. The first one is presentation of the preliminaries, the basis. So like any system of practice, we need to have a foundation for that practice. And they're often called the preliminaries. Now, unfortunately, the word preliminary, people then get a wrong idea of what that means. People, when they see the word preliminary, think, oh, that's something I do as a beginner and then I just sort of leave it behind. That's only for beginners. So I do a little bit of that at the beginning and then I throw that away and go on to higher levels of practice. This is not what preliminaries mean. So preliminaries, as it says here, is the basis of our practice. So it's not something, not only something we need to do to develop a foundation for our practice, but it's something that we need to continue to work on throughout our life. So we're going to be looking at that first. Then point 2, here it says training in the 2 minds of awakening, the main practice. So remember, here the word bodhicitta in this commentary has been translated as mind of awakening. And it says the main practice. So the second point of the 7 is these 2 practices of wisdom and compassion. So the second point is giving us slogans on how to practice emptiness and bodhicitta. Bodhicitta in terms of using the approach of exchanging self with others. So this is the main practice. Then the third point, it says, taking adverse conditions onto the path of enlightenment. So I briefly mentioned before is that one of the other great strengths of Lojong's system of practice is that it gives us a lot of practical advice about how to see difficult situations not as problems but as opportunities and how to use whatever conditions we meet as fuel for our practice. So that is the third point, and quite a large part of the commentary is based on this third point. The fourth is presentation of a lifetime's practice in summary. So what this is how to systematize all of these various instructions, how to structure them into some core areas of practice. So here we're going to see there are five parts to our practice, that all of these instructions can be sort of condensed down into these five core things. And so that's going to help us to be able to build a practice, a daily life practice, in a very clear way. So that's point four. Point five, it says, presentation of the measure of having trained the mind. So of course, whatever practice we do, it would be very handy to know whether our practice is working or not, whether we are progressing. So the fifth point here gives us a way of measuring whether or not our practice is progressing. Are we heading in the right direction? Are we making some progress in our practice? So that can be very helpful advice. Then point six and seven. Point six is presentation of the commitments of mind training. So here we see a number of slogans about various commitments of mind training. A lot of these points are phrased in terms of do not this, do not that, which means these commitments are telling us things that we need to avoid that go against this mind training practice. So this helps us to understand what sorts of things we need to avoid in order not to go against these practices of mind training. So they are going to help us in that way. Whereas the seventh point, presentation of the precepts of mind training, the precepts a little bit more about what things we need to do to support and nurture our mind training. So point six again is more about what things we need to avoid that go against mind training. Whereas point seven is more about what sorts of things do we need to do to help support and nurture our practice. So these are the seven points, and we have these 57 slogans or very short pithy statements that come within these seven points. So let's now go to the first of the seven points, the presentation of the preliminary practices, the basis. And in the commentary here it says, the first point, the presentation of the preliminaries, which is the basis, is stated by the following. So here we have the first of the 57 slogans, which is, first train in the preliminaries. So to introduce this, before we go into the commentary, I'd like to read from this book here, The Practice of Lojong by Tralok Gyapgon. So remember I said yesterday, I'm going to from time to time reference these two commentaries, two modern day commentaries. This is by Tralok Gyapgon, who's a Tibetan master within the Kagyu tradition of Tibetan Buddhism, modern day. And then also here we have Buddhism with an Attitude by Alan Wallace, who's a long-term practitioner within Tibetan Buddhism. He's a Westerner, he's American. So these then provide sort of a little bit of a modern flavor of this text. So I think this can also be very helpful in understanding these various points here. So I'd like to begin by just reading a little bit from this one about what he says is, what are these preliminaries? What are these preliminaries all about? So this is on page 15 of this book. And this word preliminaries is in Tibetan nungdro. So a number of you who've been studying a little bit in the Tibetan system probably know or have heard a lot about these nungdros. So anyway, he says the following. The preliminaries are the basis upon which we build our practice. Their contemplation leads to a sense of urgency to our spiritual endeavors and serves as an antidote to the negative tendencies that frustrate our goals. They remind us of what is really important in life and inspire us to use our time constructively instead of squandering it on meaningless and superficial activities. Time passes very quickly, and unless we recognize the urgency of our situation by thoroughly and unflinchingly reflecting on these preliminary reminders, we will dissipate our opportunities and forfeit the things that are of real benefit to us. If our spiritual practice doesn't have a strong foundation, we will never have what it takes to persevere. Myriad distractions, such as worrying about defaulting on our mortgage or paying our insurance, or scheming about how to get the boss's job, will diminish our intelligence and obscure our spiritual aspirations. Lazy and complacent, we will crawl out of bed and drift without purpose through the motions of our day. According to the Lojong texts, the antidote to this worldly malaise is to contemplate the preliminaries at the beginning of each practice session, an act that will not only sharpen our intelligence, but will renew our enthusiasm for the spiritual path. So I think then we can get a good sense of what these preliminaries are about. They're not just something that we do as a beginner and then we tick them off and then leave them behind. So let's look at these preliminaries in a little bit more detail here based on the commentary. So we're down at the bottom of page 89. It says, "The practitioner of this mind training must be someone who, by relying on a qualified teacher whose lineage stems from a teacher, has trained his or her mind in the three scopes in a systematic order and has reached a certain level. The practitioner, having generated the two awakening minds, aspiring and engaging, is cognizant of including even the minute precepts of these practices. These are the prerequisites." So here it says that the practitioner of Lojong is someone who has been relying on a qualified teacher whose lineage stems from a teacher. So remember, a teacher is the great Indian master who brought this Lojong system of practice into Tibet. So of course, if we are to take advantage of this system, then we need to be following this same lineage or style of practice. And it says here that this person has trained their mind in the three scopes in a systematic order. So what are these three scopes? Those of you, of course, who have studied a little bit the Lam Rim know very well what these three scopes are. But let's go through them anyway. So these three scopes is a way of looking at the spiritual path to enlightenment, particularly how it was structured by Lama Ratisha as it was brought into Tibet. That is the basis of the Lam Rim system of practice, the stages of the path to enlightenment. And in these three scopes, we can look at three levels as to how to make our life meaningful. And so the three scopes are talking about three levels of practitioner in how we can make our life most meaningful. And so the first scope is an initial level practitioner. So what is the minimum way in which we can make our life meaningful. And that is to strive for a good future. Because now we often just get caught up in a lot of sense pleasures, making more money, not really having a very meaningful life. And so the first minimum level is that we can make this human life meaningful is to strive for a good future. But of course, to strive for a good future, first we need to have the motivation to strive for a good future. So to help us to be motivated to make our life meaningful, then we have a number of reflections here. Is that we need to reflect on our precious human life and death and impermanence. Because otherwise we tend to just drift along in our life and there's nothing really motivating us to take advantage of this opportunity we have. But if we really reflect on our precious human life, that we have this life full of opportunities, and that it's not going to last forever. If we do these two reflections together, we will really want to make our life meaningful. We'll really want to strive for a good future. Then how do we strive for a good future is the next reflection here. We have two reflections of refuge and karma. Refuge is who or what can we turn to help us to strive for a good future. And the refuge here, of course, is in the three jewels, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And the analogy often given here is that, you know, if we're sick, who or what do we turn to for refuge if we think we're sick? Generally, we turn to refuge to the doctor because we believe that the doctor is qualified and that they can help us. And then, of course, the doctor usually helps us by prescribing some medicine. And then sometimes we maybe need to have an operation and we need to recover in hospital, and then there's some nurses that help us to recover. So this is the analogy for Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. The Buddha is like our doctor. He's qualified to help us because he has overcome suffering himself. The medicine is the Dharma, his teachings. And then the Sangha is the spiritual communities like the nurses that help us to implement the Dharma. So this is what we can turn to strive for a good future. And then the next topic is the topic of karma. This is, of course, the law of cause and effect in terms of our behavior and our experiences. So, of course, by reflecting on karma, we can understand that if we engage in harmful behavior, we'll end up with a lot of suffering. That if we engage in virtuous behavior, we'll end up with happiness. So, therefore, to strive for a good future is we reflect on karma, and that will motivate us to have an ethical lifestyle. So this is how we can then strive for a good future in as the minimum way of making our life meaningful is to have an ethical lifestyle. So this is, of course, the foundation of all Buddhist traditions, and I think it's the foundation of any spiritual tradition. I think it's the foundation of any meaningful life. So this is the initial way in which we can make our life meaningful. And so these are the sorts of reflections that can help us to actually strive for this goal of a good future. Then, of course, we can build on top of that. We can go to the next level, which is the middling scope. So, even if we strive for a good future through having an ethical lifestyle, we can understand we're still stuck in this state of dukkha. We're still stuck in this cycle of existence called samsara. So then on the basis of this, we can go to the next level, which is to not just strive for a good future, but strive to break free of this cycle of existence altogether. So at the middling level, the goal that we are striving for, of course, is nirvana. But of course, first we need to develop the motivation to strive for nirvana. So how can we develop the motivation to strive for nirvana? Is the next reflection here is that we need to reflect on the unsatisfactory state we find ourselves in. So by reflecting on dukkha, the fact that we're stuck in this unsatisfactory state, and understanding that we're stuck in this state because of our mental afflictions and ignorance, that can lead us to developing the aspiration for nirvana, which of course is renunciation. So by reflecting on dukkha, that will help us to develop this aspiration for nirvana. So remember, this is the entry point into the Buddhist spiritual path. Then how do we actually strive for the goal of nirvana? We talked about yesterday briefly these noble eightfold paths, which we can condense into those three core areas of practice of ethics, concentration, and wisdom. Sila, Samadhi, Panya. Sila, Samadhi, Panya. So this, to strive for nirvana, then we have the three higher trainings. So we need to engage in these three core practices of ethics, concentration, and wisdom. So concentration here, of course, is the shamatha practice, and the wisdom, of course, is the wisdom of no self. Anatma. So these are the practices then we need to engage in order to strive for the goal of nirvana. Then we can go to the next level of making our life meaningful. Question? Ethics, concentration, wisdom. It's mentioned in that, at the back of your booklet, that three vehicles chart, it's in there. So ethics, concentration, wisdom. Ethics, of course, in Sanskrit and Pali is Sila. Concentration is Samadhi. And wisdom in Pali is Panya, in Sanskrit Prajna. And the wisdom here, in particular, of course, is this wisdom of no self. Then we can go to the next level. That is someone of great capacity. And here, not just striving for the goal of nirvana, personal liberation from suffering, but we can take it to the next level of striving for the goal of not only liberating ourselves from samsara, but helping to liberate everyone else. So there, of course, the goal is the goal of enlightenment and the motivation, of course, to strive for the goal of enlightenment is the motivation of bodhicitta,
So how do we develop bodhicitta? Is through the two main practices. Is the seven cause and effect method and exchanging self with others. So if we work on those practices, then that will help us to develop bodhicitta. And then we'll look at this next, but I see it's now time for a morning tea break. So we can have a half hour morning tea break, come back at 10:45. So remember there's no gong for the next session, so you'll have to keep an eye on the time and be back at 10:45.